Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to fight for justice without ever taking up arms, even in self-defense? The Reverend James Lawson committed himself to the principles of nonviolent resistance at an age when many American children are still thrilled by the prospects of a good schoolyard fight. His embrace of the value of passive resistance, and more importantly, of the social justice it can affect, was deeply influential to the leaders of the American Civil Rights Movement, including Dr. Martin Luther King, who dubbed the Reverend Lawson one of the leading nonviolent theorists in the world. Lawson is distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University. He's in town to speak tonight at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in Dallas. Reverend Lawson, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
I want to talk about the foundation of your belief in nonviolent resistance. You're a Christian, and your father before you was also a minister, but it
yes.
was your mother who really was with you at this moment of epiphany. Can you talk about that?
Well, actually, it was the Christian spirit, the spirit of love and truth that permeated my home life, and also the life of the first congregation that I remember, St. James AME Zion Church in Massillon, Ohio. And basically, the foundation of that was the life of Jesus and the teachings of Jesus that first formed me into recognizing the necessity of what my mother called a better way. And that way, initially, I simply called love. And truth, but in time met Gandhi through his autobiography, 1947, and that convinced me that the proper term was not pacifism and not passive resistance, even, which is an honored term of the past, but is nonviolent resistance. And the nonviolence comes out of a transcript word, a Sanskrit word, that Gandhi used, ahimsa, and it's one of those words that we don't have in the English language, where the non is not a negative but a positive. So nonviolence is not about being anti-violence so much as it is being pro-compassion, pro-reverence for life, pro the sanctity of human life. That's much more the notion of nonviolence. And then the other side of it is trying to live without injuring creation, without injuring living things. That comes from an ancient Hindu religion, Jainism, that early on, 300, 400 years before Jesus, put the emphasis upon reverence for life, though that's not the way they would have said it.
What do you do with anger when you have committed yourself to nonviolence?
Well, we human beings are emotional creatures. We have fears. We have animosities. And so most of the great religions of the world, including Judaism and Christianity, place an emphasis upon the human being becoming the manager of those fears and angers. So the Hebrew Christian Bible says, be angry, but do not sin. That is, that you know, if you, for whatever reason, you have anger or temper, then recognize that, own it, but then let your heart shape how you use the anger. So do not injure yourself or your reputation, and then do not injure other people. So that's the meaning of that little phrase, be angry, but do not sin. So it's not a notion of probably ever making it go away. It's rather that you put your own self, your own personhood, in charge of it. So the fear doesn't dominate you. And that, of course, almost anyone will tell you, in a battlefield, it's not the absence of fear that counts. It's the fact that people will use their courage to put down the fear and do what they think they need to do for that situation. There are those who think Buddhism has a form and Hinduism has a form of religious practice in which they think they will rid themselves of anger, but I maintain that anger is a part of the human condition. I found myself several weeks ago with my 3-year-old grandson in Los Angeles getting quite upset with him, and I had to grab myself by the throat.
3-year-olds will do that to you.
Yeah, that's right. I had to grab myself by the throat, you know, and say, now let's recognize what this is going on and where we are and who you are, and begin to calm myself and not allow myself to respond in an upset fashion.
You were drafted in 1951 and declared yourself a conscientious objector. You could have taken a deferment as a student or on religious grounds, but you chose not to do that. Can you talk about why?
Yes. Well, as I was growing up and practicing worship and prayer and study and finding my own life transformed, I recognized that the society with its racism and some of the racial slurs that I received in hostile situations at a fairly early age in Ohio were wrong. That those racial slurs were an insult to my basic humanity and who I was as a child of God, as the son of my parents and a member of my family. So I knew that was absolutely immoral and unacceptable. Well, in time, I recognized that all forms of violence were unacceptable. So actually, what happened was that I registered for the draft in 1946, I think it was, at age 18, which was law. But then by 1948, 49, I was convinced that I could not allow myself as a follower of Jesus to put on a uniform with guns and the rest of it on my hips. So I sent my cards back. So that actually happened by 1949. And I declared myself then as a draft resister. So it was a matter of conscience. I felt that I did not want to take advantage of a ministerial deferment or a student deferment because so many other students didn't have such options, mm-hmm. such access. And I said I was not going to do something. I felt that I should not accept those loopholes for myself, that I wanted to be identified as with most students in the way in which most students were having to wrestle. So I sent my cards back. Then the Korean War happened in 1950, but I was drafted actually. I was actually drafted in 1949, and I did not report. I sent the draft notice back with a letter explaining my position to the local draft board. So then all of that came to a head when I was arrested in the fall of 1950. And tried in 1951.
The notion of prison for a well-educated boy who had grown up with a loving family and you know a church community around him must have been a scary thing for you.
I was nervous about it, but not scared, because in the literature that's available, Gandhi used prison as a time for reading and writing. Mm. Nehru did the same through Nehru of India. So lots of prisoners have used prison as a time for deepening their understanding of themselves and their world. And I had talked to Methodist clergy who had been in jail as conscientious objectors in World War II. I had talked to people like George Hauser and Glenn Smiley and Jim Farmer and Bayard Rustin and a number of others. I can't think of all of them immediately, a great number of people in my college years about all of this. And so I basically prepared myself to face prison. I couldn't be absolutely sure of the unknown, but I was prepared to go to jail. And this stood me in good stead because then, in the sit-in movement, the nonviolent struggles from 58 on, I taught what you do with jail if you're arrested in the process of time. That this can be a period of creativity, and for many people followed my leadership on that. They followed my teaching on that.
Did you also find yourself sort of ministering to the other inmates while you were there?
I found out that the folk I journeyed with in prison in 51, 52 were all very human beings. Mm-hmm. Even the people, the men I met who consider themselves as professional criminals, one of them who argued with me all the time because he said he was a professional mugger, and he said that my vocation is as worthy as your vocation going into ministry. We had arguments about this.
I can imagine.
So I discovered great humanity. I think the issue here is, from a religious point of view, from a Jesus point of view, that all of us have been endowed with the likeness and the image of life itself, or God, for the many people who say God. And that means, therefore, that we are a peculiar living species. We're the only species who's learned to read and write and talk and sing and invent and create civilizations, create families and villages and farms and homes. We're the only living species of maybe the 50 billion species that's lived on Earth over the billions of years. So out of that essential character of our peculiarity and yet our common elements of what it is to be human, in prison persuaded me that a man could be a criminal but still fundamentally human. And very often the criminality comes out of circumstance and not out of some demented pathology.
They're not born bad.
They're not born bad, mm-hmm. Yeah.
After prison, you went to India for several years,
yes.
And it seems like an amazing time in your professional mm-hmm. life and just in your sort of evolution as a person.
Yes, I from my early college days, I had wanted to test my faith and my theology outside of the American culture. And so when the opportunity came where the Methodist Church was recruiting people like myself out of college to go teach English and do a variety of things, I took it and so went to India. And I was glad that it was India, especially because this is where Gandhi lived and worked, and it gave me a chance to follow Gandhi, to walk in his footsteps in a sense, to go to some of the places where he worked, to speak with some of the Hindus and Muslims and Christians who supported that independence movement through nonviolence. And that included the chance that I've got, therefore, to be in close circles with the Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, one of the, extraordinary people of the 20th century also.
Let me stop you right there. We have to take a quick break. My guest this hour is the Reverend James Lawson. He is in town to speak tonight at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in Dallas. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is civil rights leader Reverend James Lawson. He is in town to speak tonight at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in Dallas. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Reverend Lawson, while you were in India, were you thinking about the ways that Gandhi's ideas would have to be modified in any way to sort of fit with American culture?
Well, I thought about lots of that in the United States, mm-hmm. having, you know, beginning to study Gandhi in 1947 on. Well, for example, the sit-in. My first sit-in occurred in Massillon, Ohio, in Indianapolis, Indiana. The sit-in was used in the United States as one technique. Gandhi did not invent any of that. He simply honed it and becomes, in my judgment, the father of nonviolence, in the same way that Albert Einstein became in the 20th century the father of physics. So the philosophy underneath nonviolence has repetitions all around the world, including in Judaism and Christianity. So that while I adopted the term nonviolence and studied the methodologies that Gandhi coined and all. Martin King said this well, we use the methods of Gandhi and the spirit of Christ. And that's something that a lot of people haven't come to understand in the United States. There was not any central structural issue with the application of nonviolent methods in the United States. And in fact, maybe the United States has a far richer history of what we can call nonviolence than most other countries in the world, because the Boston Tea Party was an example of nonviolent technique. The refusal to purchase British goods in the 18th century revolutionary period was an example. The refusal to pay taxes, the agitation, the letter by Thomas Paine, Common Sense, that would be called the process of agitation and protest in nonviolence. That was February 1776 that was published. It became the most widely read piece of a pamphlet in the United States, in the colonies, rather, it should be said. So there was no serious problem, in our judgment, of applying the techniques and methods of nonviolence, none of which Gandhi actually invented. And a scholar by the name of Gene Sharp did a 25-year research on written history and pulled out of that written history 194 different nonviolent techniques that have been used by humankind and that are in the written history of the people of the world. 194 different methods, different techniques, different instruments for creating change.
So you left India and moved to Nashville, and we'll talk about Vanderbilt in a couple of minutes. But I want to talk to you first about the experience and how it must have been. Clearly there was racism in Ohio, but it must have been quite different for you to suddenly immerse yourself in the South pre-civil rights.
Well, again, it's a complicated story, mm-hmm. because I did not come from India to Nashville. I returned from India to my home in Massillon, Ohio, and enrolled in the Graduate School of Theology at Oberlin College, mm-hmm. in Ohio. And I did not then move south until January of 1958. Nashville was very obviously far more visibly segregated and also had had hostility in various ways. In the major shopping area of Nashville downtown, black people often were treated with surliness, mm-hmm, and hostility. A mother shopping for shoes for her children could not try the shoes on the children before she bought them. And often she was told this in almost gleeful tones that she had to buy the shoes on sight. Things like this, you see, would be a major feature of the difference in Nashville. But at the same time, I went to Divinity School, the Divinity School at Vanderbilt University, and I found at that Divinity School, I found a very human community. I found friendship, collegiality. I found folk who had similar ideas to mine in terms of nonviolence and also in terms of compassion for humankind, and compassion which disdained the racism and the segregation that was to be found in Nashville. So America is a human people, and we are very complicated people. So even when we think in terms of a thing like segregation, in many parts of the country that was informal, not legal. It was by custom, mm-hmm, and by the pervasiveness of the teaching of racism. North, south, east, west. In Nashville, the segregation was all three of those. Though there was no segregation law that said that you had to have white-colored signs in front of restrooms or drinking fountains, or that you could not try on a pair of shoes that you may have needed to buy, that you could try that one before. There were no laws in Nashville that said that.
People just assumed they could get away with it.
It became a custom that was imposed upon Nashville. Mm-hmm. Not by law. Alabama, it was different. Right. There you had a whole stringent set of laws, of segregation laws, and in Mississippi, but not in Nashville. You didn't have any law saying that said that in New York, a Jew couldn't go into certain restaurants, or the dirty Irish signs that existed in New York, you see, or in Pittsburgh, the WAP signs. Now, these signs were actually all over the country. And we in the United States make a mistake by trying to pretend that this issue of segregation, Jim Crow law, racism, was primarily a southeastern or south-central problem. It was a national problem. In California, you had what's called sunset cities, where a sign outside the city limits said no colored, no Jew should be in this city after sunset.
We had them in Texas, too. A lot of places. They were in Texas,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, all over the country. Mm-hmm. You had no chink signs, no Mexican signs. So people, therefore, misunderstand the whole movement of which I was a part, because the whole movement in our work caused effectually those signs coming out of windows, mm-hmm, the waiting rooms ceasing to be segregated. All those signs across the country were made illegal by the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. See? So the movement helped the whole nation to move to a different level of our humanity and of our understanding of one another.
Did getting there require you to find a way to see the humanity as much in people who had these just vile racist beliefs as you saw the humanity in the professional mugger when you were in prison?
Different circumstance.
Yeah.
but fundamentally the same spirituality that dictated the criminal as a human being also dictated for Dr. King and for Diane Nash and for myself that the KKK member is still a recipient of the grace of God.
Seems hard. It's hard for me to get that through my head. Was it a challenge for you, or did, at that point, had you given this enough thought?
Not by the time of 1958. I don't think that's ever been a challenge for me. Probably because my parents taught us to treat everyone with decency and fairness, to not cuss at anybody, not to call names, to see other people as we saw ourselves, to be a human being. And the term that, as I remember very well, my mother and father used, the term be natural as a human being. Don't let yourself get contorted in the basic fact that you are a boy and you're a human boy and that you are loved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is civil rights leader James Lawson. He's in town to speak tonight in Dallas at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters. Let's speak to Michael in Rockwall. Hello, Michael.
Hi. How y'all doing today?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to ask your guest a quick question on one of my favorite Gandhi quotes. I always find some amusement in. It goes something like, I like your Christ, but I don't like your Christians. They're so unlike your Christ. I was just wondering if you knew any background to where that came from or what his take was on it.
Are you familiar with the quote? No. Can you talk a little, maybe in a different way, but it's related. There are a lot of practicing Christians today who don't have a problem with going to war or with using violence to achieve a variety of ends. And these are people who consider themselves true followers. What is it that they don't see that you do see in Christian tradition? Or can you explain the disconnect?
That's a very difficult question now. For one thing, they don't see war clearly. For the last 100 years, war has not had high moral ground. There are no wars in the world today where one can say we're trying to achieve a just end. That's more hypocrisy than anything else. Almost all of the wars going on, the killings that are going on in the Congo, 5 or 6 million people have been killed there in the last 7-8 years with a variety of different guerrilla units and militia groups and army groups involved in the killing and the rape and the devastation. Well, that's really all about management and control. It's not about any major goal that is altruistic. Mm-hmm. Our wars in the Middle East and in Central Asia, Afghanistan and Iraq, about a drive in certain elements of American society to control and manage the supply of oil for decades to come and to profit from them. Now, President Bush, President Obama put terms of necessity and whatnot and whatnot. That's an awesome contradiction of human life. The second thing I want to say is that most of the wars of the last 100 years, the women and the children are the major victims. The families of people, ordinary people like ourselves, are what is being designated and decimated. Any kind of a careful examination of that, I think, would turn most people off. But many of us are very lazy in making decisions that are life and death decisions for ourselves and for others. We do not examine carefully what is going on. War and violence have become, in the 20th century, they became the essential enemy of the human family in two ways. In the unparalleled devastation of women and children, and then in the direction of massive human, technological, financial resources down a kind of infinite hole, not producing benefits of any quality to the world. And I have watched in my lifetime this addiction of violence taking hold of people's minds and controlling them rather than their mind or their heart, controlling their attitudes.
When you say the past 100 years, of course, that includes the Second World War, which yes. many Americans who oppose current conflict still say was, at the heart of it, a just war, particularly in terms of the European theater and stopping Hitler.
Well, I was in high school, junior high and high school in those years, and I considered it also a necessary war, a just war. My study and reading would remind me of something that it wasn't that clean. It had all the complications of human frailty and sin in it, including the development of a foreign policy in which we turned our attention to a Cold War, and that Cold War dominated us for 50 years. And the Cold War was so demonic that a Gandhi was seen as a bad man, a Nelson Mandela was called by leaders of our country a communist and a terrorist. So the Cold War itself allowed us to dehumanize millions and millions of people in the world who were people like ourselves seeking a promised land.
Reverend James Lawson is my guest in town to speak tonight at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Reverend James Lawson, civil rights leader. He is in town to speak tonight at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in Dallas. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk for a few minutes about your relationship to Dr. King. You first met him in the 1950s?
We first shook hands February 6, 1957.
Did you sense instantly that he was sort of an ideal figure to really be at the forefront of what you were trying to do in terms of the public face of things?
Well, I didn't think in terms of an ideal sort of figure. When I first met his name in the newspaper in Nagpur, India, on the front page with the announcement in December 6, 1955, that I think it said 50,000 Negroes boycott.
This is Montgomery.
In Montgomery, Alabama, you see. Well, that for me was a moment of great exhilaration, and because that was something I had been hoping and expecting to see happen.
Yeah.
That was a part of my aspiration for change in the United States. So I followed him carefully, and I saw in him simply the emergence of that person who was going to symbolize our use of mass action and direct action and nonviolent action. I found him, when we first shook hands, he was a wonderfully gentle, loving, highly intelligent, and highly privileged man of my age. And that's one of the things that attracted me to him the first time. There was no entourage around him or around me as we met in a private dining room at Oberlin. And no one else had gotten there, so we had a chance to visit together and share. And I also saw him as, in a very real way, the person with whom I would want to be connected if I were going to get in the struggle later on, because I told him of my study and my interest and the thought that I would go move south to be a United Methodist pastor one day. And this was towards the end of our time together then. And Martin looked at me across the table and said very simply, don't wait. Come now. We need you now. And then went on to talk about that. So my impressions of him were as a young person, young man to young man, and with a great sense that we were in a special time in the world, in our own country, and that the opportunities for moving upon a critical sin in American society were very ripe.
So much of the work that you both did relied on very young people to lead these movements, and you worked a lot with students and sort of taught them about nonviolence. Can you talk about how you sort of grew as a mentor, and maybe you were great at it from the beginning, and maybe it was something that you had to come to over time?
All right. I want to start off by saying that there's a lot of romantic writing about the movement mm-hmm. that tends to miss a basic characteristic. The first direct action things that went on in the South, Tallahassee, Florida, Orangeburg, South Carolina, Montgomery, Alabama, Baton Rouge, and elsewhere, were vastly intergenerational. The Little Rock Nine, who I visited with for their first conversations on nonviolence, could not have happened without their parents and their congregations and without the NAACP and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the lawyers, you see? So the tendency is to yank out of a larger picture the idea of the romantic young. We were intergenerational. Nashville worked most effectively because I and other adults recruited college students to join the workshops in September of 1959 for nonviolent training and struggle, to study the Montgomery bus boycott as a premier illustration of nonviolence. Where the young were deeply involved in the movement is that every revolution of any kind, including 1776, requires the enthusiasm, the energy, the zeal, the commitment to sacrifice and hard work that young people can make early on in their lives if they are challenged in various ways. So that's the great power. But that helps to fuel the community to act with strength and dignity. And Nashville was the most effective sit-in campaign in the early months and then long-term because it was initiated by the Nashville Christian Leadership Council, made up of lay people and clergy, black lay people and clergy, who were determined that we must desegregate downtown Nashville and that this can be done best through nonviolent spirituality and action. That's not to take away from the role that John Lewis has played or Diane Nash or a number of other people, but it is to say that that if we are going to change our country from where it is today to where it needs to be, it will have to be a combination of generations in the United States that works for that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Robert in Plano. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Appreciate the show, and I just would like your guest's comments on the present reality of the treatment of illegal immigrants in that community in our country, specifically the embodiment in law that's coming to pass in a number of states, making it illegal to even help or give a ride to an illegal immigrant who may be broke down on the side of the road. And if your guest sees this as maybe the next frontier of civil rights in our country.
Thanks for your call.
Well, it seems to me that the anti-immigration, anti-immigrant spirituality is a demonic, demonstrates the demonic plight of the 300 million people of the United States, and not our our better estimations of ourselves or of our purpose as a nation. In my mind, there is no such thing as an undocumented human being in the sight of God or an illegal human being. And the Declaration of Human Rights that the United Nations proposed some years ago, that's been signed by 180 nations but not by the United States, says that the right of people to move where they feel they can have a better access to what they want in life, their aspirations, and it's a responsibility of the governments to paper this in a fashion so that it can be done. That people are always going to be ambitious for themselves and for their families. So I think this is very wrong. I think that it brings out something of the sexist, racist spirituality of the United States, of many people, and that what needs to happen is for the political parties and President Obama to go after doing the changes in our bureaucracies as well as the changes in our laws that will allow the people who have come, 90-odd percent of whom are like ourselves, hardworking, trying to get ahead in life, loving their children and trying to raise them. That's the way that will lead to a better America and not this other business. There are estimated by study groups in the United States, 2 million children, it's 2 million young people, college age, who were brought here at a very early age, have been in schools in America all their lives. They are graduating from our community colleges and our state colleges to the number that is close to 2 million. Many of them are going off into graduate work in a variety of fields that can only mean huge contributions to the life of this nation. If the American people knew about these nearly 2 million students, 18 to 25 and 30, without papers, I think they would call for President Obama to issue an executive order to give them some kind of temporary process to fulfill their dreams at being citizens while they pursue the course of their lives for themselves and their families. A number of these students are risking great vulnerability because they are marching from Miami, Florida. They began January 1 to be in Washington, D.C. on May 1 to try to say to Congress, we want access. And I met one of these people in December in Nashville, Tennessee. She has 2 master's degrees. She has worked 3 jobs to stay in high school and to go to community college and to the university. She's one of the people that I've met in this group of people. Astonishing young men and women. And we don't even know they exist in our land. That, to me, is the tragedy. Because ignorance cannot be an excuse for doing wrong.
Were you troubled at all by President Obama's acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize, in which at least part of the speech was devoted to a defense of the American way of war?
Yes, I think it's a problematic speech. It was a problematic speech. It had some good points in it, but basically it was a reiteration of the just war thesis that was started by St. Augustine in the fourth century in the Roman Catholic Church, and that has ever since been one of the ethical sorts of ways that many Christians, scholars especially, and preachers have looked at war. The thing that was left out of that analysis and justification for the just war theory is that there are several criteria for a just war. One of them is that non-combatants are not killed. And all of the wars of the last 100 years have been wars with, as I've said already, the babies, the children, the women are the major people being killed. Now, we excuse ourselves because we know how many American soldiers have been wounded and how many have been killed in Iraq, but we have no idea of the numbers of civilians, Iraqi people, Iraqi women. And I think there is a conspiracy in the media and in the scholarly world to deliberately not get those figures before the American people. Because if the American people knew that just in the sanctions alone in the decade of the 90s, 500,000 Iraqi babies died from our sanctions of the British government and the American government, I think the American people would probably be in great protest to that. If we knew how many women and children have been killed in Iraq in these last 8 years, that's right, it's almost 8 years, 2003, 2010, 7 years.
It would change everything.
And that reminds me of something, you see, namely that you cannot have a human race with ignorance.
I'm sorry that we're out of time. It's been a great conversation. Reverend Lawson is in town to speak tonight at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in Dallas. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.